Hello and welcome to Fueling Around with me, Jason Plato, and my co-pilot and navigator, Dave Vitti.
Hello.
Fueling Around is powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your car, your bike, or your home insurance. So then, how are you, mate?
How are you, boss? You right?
I'm very good. I'm noticing you. Have you had a shave? You're looking really clean and sharp.
Yeah. You see, this is the beauty of this lockdown world that we live in and that we're recording in, because on a daily basis, we can sort of examine how each other's doing. Yeah, I had a shave since I saw you last, so I'm looking quite smooth at the moment. And actually, your beard, Mr. Plato, is looking very, very dapper and very trim as well, I'd say.
Well, do you know what? I'm good friends with Damon Hill, and we go out and have lunch every Christmas, and he sports ever since he kind of... You know, he went through that like wild rebel stage with long hair. And then he sharpened himself up, and I think he looks great. Anyway, I got a little text from him the other day saying, "Are you trying to nick my style?" What a compliment. Yeah, do you know what? I'm all right with it. It's a bit itchy, but I think I might keep it.
No, it looks good. It looks good. And listen, without further ado and beard news, we should open the door to our special guest today.
We should. Our special guest is a multi-talented musician, a rapper, a singer-songwriter, a DJ, and he's an absolute car nutter. So he's going to fit just perfect on this show. It is the one and only Maxi Jazz. Hello, mate. How are you?
Hello, JP. How are you, sir?
I'm very well. Good to see you. How's it all been going in this weird world we're in at the moment?
Oh, well, nothing is happening. I mean, if you're a musician, everything has stopped, really. So I've just been in my house, sort of messing around on my guitars, writing stuff, and waiting for it all to be over, essentially.
So, mate, obviously, you know, we know you from, you know, the epic anthems. I mean, you know... My mum is familiar with Insomnia. I mean, everybody I know knows that song. Where did that come from?
That song was the living B-side. We had finished the album, Reverence, and Rollo was in the studio compiling. Compiling is when you have 9, 10 songs and you decide which one's going to be first, which second, which third.
Yeah.
Compiling. And Rollo's sitting there thinking, well, if I was making a normal album instead of a CD... it would have two sides.
Mm-hmm.
And I would want a dance track on both sides.
Right.
At the time, we only had Salva Meir. It was the one dance track on the record. So this was on a Sunday. He called up Blissey on the Sunday night and said, meet me in the studio, we're going to make another dance track. Now, these are people who take weeks to make a dance track. But on this occasion, they knocked it all up in the one session on the Monday. Yeah. Called me Monday night and said, Maxi, we've made another dance track and we're going to call it Insomnia because Bliss is having trouble getting kicked. Do you think you can write some words? And I said, yep, no problem. I'll see you tomorrow night at 7. So I put the phone down and I spent about 20 minutes cobbling some ideas together there and then. Then I went to the studio the next evening at 7. I spent about another 15, 20 minutes getting just the lyrics just finished off.
Mm-hmm.
Another 20, 25 minutes in the booth putting them down. And then I went home.
Good Lord.
And that was that.
Did you have any idea at the time that it was going to be this huge monster?
None at all. I mean, I remember Rollo ringing me up saying that he's never heard lyrics like that on a house record before, which was nice of him to say. But none of us had any inkling that it was going to... We all kind of thought, look, you know, we're having fun here, we're doing what we want, but let's not any of us be stupid enough to expect, you know, commercial success with this.
How great. What a mega story. Mate, cars, big part of your life. Tell us about cars. When did that kick off?
I was quite young, really, and I think the first... time I saw a black guy in a nice car. I was in Croydon, and here was his fur, dressed to the nines, in a bright yellow Triumph Stag, and I thought, oh, I want something like one of these days. And I bought my mum's Mark II Ford Escort, bright orange, black vinyl roof, Ford Escort GL 1.3, and I loved that little car. You'd go around the corner at any speed you like. But it didn't have the oomph, you know, because it only had a 1.3.
Yeah.
So my first thing was, right, I want one of them RS2000s with like a 2-litre Pinto. That'll give you some kick. So that was actually the first car that I bought. Nordic Blue. I've still got it. And it's
Have you?
It's a gem. Wow. It's a gem of a car, yeah. And the thing of it is it now, I've had it restored, and you drive it around now and you can't believe the amount of men of a certain age.
Oh, yeah.
Who get...
Open jaw.
Get all misty-eyed. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, oh, mate, your car's fantastic. It's an original. Like, yeah, yeah, all that stuff. It's great. Straight after that, I bought a Cosworth.
Wow.
Escort or Sierra?
Sierra, it's a Sapphire. Sapphire, yeah. It wasn't the Mark 1, it's the Mark 2, yeah. Do you know they only weigh 1,200 kilos, those cars?
Is that right?
That car is scary fast. Yeah.
Even in today's money?
Even in today's money, you would get in that car, put your foot down, going, oh, my God! Still got that too.
Have you? Good on you.
Yeah.
You're so right about the cars of that era, you know, the hot cars, whether they were Cosworths or whether they were kind of RS2000s. Now, for people of our age, when we see them on the roads, it is far more exciting than seeing a Ferrari go past or a Lamborghini or anything like that.
Yeah, yeah.
I was literally walking at the
end. Part of your childhood.
Yeah, at the end of my road the other day, and an absolutely mint XR2 came past, a Mark 1. And I saw it and I just thought, literally, head turn. And I was like, wow.
Yeah. Especially if they're in good nick, you just think, wow, yeah.
I know.
Yeah, I drove, we did a little item on Fifth Gear a while ago, which is to look at these cars, which we all remember from our childhood as the best things ever. For instance, the Escort Cosworth. And then we got one from Ford, and it's brand new, this thing. It's done like 300-400 miles. It's in their museum. They let us drive it. Oh, man, it was lush. It was, but also when you're in it, I felt like I was in a greenhouse because all the A pillars are tiny and there's like, it's just a whole different sort of car. But it was amazing.
It's like the TARDIS, isn't it? You're stepping into a different world when you get into those cars. You know, it's all about you, the steering wheel and your bum.
I can guarantee a Triumph Stag will still drive like a bit of a shed, though. Look great.
Yeah, they were far better to look at than they were for anything else because they were dreadful to drive. And the thing is that they would conk out every third trip anyway. The amount of times you see a beautiful looking stag on the hard shoulder with someone there with steam coming out of it.
There can't be many of them left. They're all just all turned to paper, haven't they? I would imagine most of those.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I grew up a bit and got a bit more sensible, I started to look elsewhere for my thrills.
And looking where? To a German manufacturer or
German cars? I never really. I love the old BMW 3 Series, the 323i. I used to really like that car, but BMWs and Audis never really did it for me. To be fair, I remember in '97. I think we'd been successful about a year, and I took my brother to this. Computer fair in Earlscourt, and they've always got a stand with some stush cars in it. And I saw this Marcos, you know, it was just like the Batmobile.
Yeah.
And I knew about Marcos GTSs because back in the 70s, there was a car shop in Norbury that used to sell them. And they looked a bit E-type-ish with Scimitar bumpers and all that, and a bit of a fastback at the back. But this new Marcos LM500 was like, wow, what is this? So the next day I was doing a Channel 5. You remember the big breakfast?
Yeah.
So I was doing that the next day and they asked me if I was going to get rid of my little Ford Escort, a decent car. So I told him I'm keeping my Ford Escort no matter what, but if I was to get another car, well. And I started to wax lyrical about this Marcos. So some of the workers at Marcos saw the interview, told the boss, he got in touch via the record company, saying, anytime you want to road test one of the cars, only give me a ring. I was like, where
is it? Now you...
I'll be there in 10 minutes.
Right. Now you've let the genie out of the bottle. And to this day, even though I've got two Marcoses now myself, but to this day, that's one of the best weekends of my life.
Is that right?
Driving that British Racing Green Marcos 500 up and down the country all weekend. It was fantastic. I had the top down. I got so many thumbs ups and you know, mate, wicked car. And I'd be like, it's not mine.
Not mine yet.
Exactly. I don't know why I said that, but you know, that was it. But that was a beautiful weekend. And I like things that are slightly unusual, to be fair. So the Marcos has really appealed to me. And since then, I got myself the one Ferrari that I really, really liked, because I'm not really a Ferrari person, to be honest with you. But the 456, yeah. What a lovely looking thing that is. So I thought, I'm going to get one. I'm going to get one. And they're amazing. It's one of the very few cars you get in it and you think, whoa.
It is extraordinary, isn't it? Wait, if you drive a Ferrari in Italy.
It was amazing. And I remember pulling up behind this camper van, and this guy was getting his family out, his two small kids and his wife and that. And he looked back and he saw the Ferrari and he just ran over, pulled the passenger door open and said, my son is okay. And he plonked his sort of 8-year-old son on the passenger seat, started taking pictures.
Cool.
Made his whole family sit in my passenger seat to take pictures and then himself. And then waved, said, thank you very much, and off he went.
Brilliant. Brilliant.
It sounds to me, Max, from what you're saying, that actually you're a man who doesn't part easily with cars. You know, cars that you've owned, you tend to still have?
Exactly, yeah. It's once I've formed a relationship with a motor car, that's it, it's mine. And whatever happens, it's staying right here. Thank you very much indeed for asking. It's not going anywhere. I know it's a bit silly, but that's me.
Well, do you know what? I'm not like that, and I'm not sure why I am like that. Probably because of the way I use cars in my day job, I guess, but I wish I had been like that. Oh, my word, I've let some crackers go for not a lot of money, which now if I'd had them... I mean, I had a 993 Turbo S.
I know, right?
Which was, the original Widowmaker, they call this thing. It was silver, the last air-cooled Turbo 911, and I let it go for like 40 grand or something like that. It's £500,000 for the car, that now.
Is it?
Yeah.
£500,000?
£500,000, good, a good one. But of course you just never know, do you? You never know. But I wish I'd kept some cars.
You just don't know. I bought a Porsche recently.
Which? Have you got electric? Have you gone with the Taycan?
Are you mad? I can't get to have some noise for me to be interested in it.
But same.
Sorry, world. Yeah. But that's how it is. Petrolhead, you know. I bought the 911 Ford GTS.
Wicked. They are great, aren't they?
It's an absolute killer. Yeah, it's four-wheel drive, so you can go around the corner at any speed you like. And it's already fast when you get in it. And then you see the two buttons, Sport and Sport Plus.
Sport Plus.
And let me tell you, Sport Plus is for the track. Do not bother with it on the road, because you'll find yourself in the back of somebody before you know what's happened to you. It is amazing. Yeah. And it's so easy to drive. That's the thing with it. The Marcos is you have to, they're a bit wiggly, you know what I mean? Yeah. So, you've got to concentrate on what you're doing. This thing is so easy to drive at, like, huge speed that's what you want to do all the time. So I just sort of stay away from the sport buttons and try and pretend I'm going to say yes.
But, I mean, they are phenomenal for that, aren't they? Literally, they're the easiest thing to drive.
Unbelievable.
Quickest cars from A to B.
When I got in it and I drove it, I thought, no. No, these cars really should be illegal.
Is there anything that you have owned that you got rid of and now deeply regret?
I had a Subaru. My best mate bought one. I thought, oh, God, that's a great car. I'm going to get one of those.
Yeah.
And that's the only car I've ever sold.
Really?
And, yeah, I kind of wish it was still there. But I'm not, I'm not heartbroken over it. Let's put it like that. Mm-hmm. It's fine. I miss, if there's anything that I really miss, if I'm honest with you, it's racing.
Yeah.
It's I miss coming to the track scared bloody stiff. and spending the weekend in a motorhome scared bloody stiff, and then getting out onto the track and thinking, oh, I know what to do. I miss that terribly, but
Are there any similarities between the nerves that you get pre-race and the nerves that you presumably get before a performance?
They're very similar. I very rarely got nervous towards the latter stages of Faithless, because you knew it was a sellout. You knew they'd all come to see you. You knew they were going to enjoy themselves. So your nerves were kind of more like, Maxie, don't slacken off.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, don't get complacent with this. I have my own band now, and the nerves that I would get before going on stage with my own band, that's a completely different thing. I would be trembling.
Really?
Because it's your band, your songs, your everything. And so it's a bit like going into a room full of people, dropping your trousers and going, what do you think?
Have a look at me. What do you reckon?
What do you reckon? Exactly. It's exactly what it's like. So when you get applause or cheering or whatever, it's the thrill is manifestly greater than if you're doing it, say, with Faithless, and that responsibility is spread over a whole bunch of people. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Interesting.
So that's the thing. You're getting all of this love. But like I said, you can only enjoy it when it's over. A bit like racing.
Yeah.
In fact, a lot like racing.
It's a bit like racing. The weird thing with me with the racing is that the sexy bit is in the moment, is doing it. And when the checkered flag comes down, of course, there's, you know, there's some pretty girls to kiss and a bit of champagne to throw on the floor. Yeah. But as soon as that's over, boom, it's I'm on to the next thing. Right, next race. But the sexy bit is in the moment.
Yeah. For me, it was a bit like when you're racing, only you know how many times as you turn the wheel, the car was going, I'm not so sure I want to go. Oh, all right then, boom. And you're on the apex and you're like, phew, made it. Because being on the limit is a really uncomfortable experience because you just don't know from one second, this is me anyway, from one second to another, whether you've overdone it, whether you've got it just right. And so only you know how many times you came close to crashing.
Yeah.
And then when you see that finishing, when you see that checkered flag, I've cried before now. On the slow down lap, I've had to slow right down because I can't bloody see.
Excellent.
You know, because the tears. It's so, I mean, the thing of it is it's a lot like racing. Sorry, a lot like gigging, except that when you're gigging, you've got sort of 8 or 9 people on the stage with you trying to make you look good.
Yeah.
When you're racing, you've got 20-odd other people trying to make you look like a fool.
Do you know what? I've never thought about it like that way. You're dead right.
Right. And so when you actually finish the race, for me, this was like, I've done it. It didn't actually matter where I finished. Yeah. But the fact, that little fluttering black and white checkered flag, that would bring out emotion in me that I can't even begin to describe. Because back of your mind, you know it's dangerous.
Yeah.
See, did you know that Dave has done a bit of driving? Dave's raced at Silverstone.
I have done a bit of, I have done a bit of driving. I did my ARDS test at Thruxton many moons ago.
Now there's a track.
There's a track. No, I've been lucky actually over the years. I've done quite a few track days, and any opportunity that I've had to get out on a track, you know, hopefully at someone else's expense, I've always taken it gratefully. The Ginetta people I know very well, so I've done umpteen Ginetta days, etc., etc. Which has been great. It's a fantastic experience. But I don't know about you, I do quite like go-karting as well, and I find there's a real difference. In a kart, I consider myself to be almost fearless because I think I'm never going to get hurt. I'm going to drive this absolutely 100%. Whereas when I'm in a car on the track, I don't know what the figures are, but I would say that I never really push myself beyond about 80 or 85% because I think deep down, there's always that feeling, and you sort of reminded me of it then before, Max, that you think you might hurt yourself.
Yeah.
You know, you think, if I get this wrong, you know, if I lose a back end on this fast corner, I'm going to be straight in that Armco and that's going to hurt and is going to be expensive. Whereas on a car, I don't really care. I just go for it. And it's a strange thing.
No, I get it's a very pure form of racing. The fact you've got no gears.
Yeah.
Right. It means you've got to get the corners right in order to get any momentum to get some speed around the circuit. And it's also really hard work physically.
Oh, yes. Yeah,
really hard.
You know, rather than driving a car, it's hard on your body, and that is one of the wonderful things about karting. I would never ever not go-karting unless, you know, I was physically incapable of doing it.
Do you know where it gets me? Go-karting. It always gets me. There's a spot on my back, and it's sort of towards the bottom of my back, and I always get it the next day. And it's basically where that hard seat is doing that, and it's smacking you all the way through, and you're really tensed up.
Well, Martin Howell had a go-kart track about 10 minutes from where I live in Streatham. And me and Dave, my best mate, we used to go go-karting there all the time. And there was a very fast double right-hander followed by a hairpin. But on the line that you needed to be on to be quick was this massive bump. And so every time you did a lap, you would have to go over. There was no two ways about it. You couldn't go around it because you wouldn't be quick. That's the end of it.
Yeah.
So you had to go over this bump and it would jar you from your toenails to the top of your head. You'd feel your fillings rattling around in your mouth and you're just like, why am I doing this? But, you know, you had to do it because there was no way I was going to let Dave's time be better than mine. So, of course, the bump is part of it, you know. And I'm thinking to myself, if it hurts that much in a go-kart, what the hell must it be like in a Formula One
car? Insane, eh?
Yeah.
Absolutely insane. In fact, I took Tiff karting for an item we did. And Tiff never grew up with karts. He was always a bit, oh, yeah, they're just, they're not proper things.
Right.
And we had the international spec car at PF International up in, you know, the best track in the UK, proper sticky tyres. And he cracked a rib just through cornering.
Did he?
And he had to pull out. He couldn't race it. He couldn't drive anymore. And then he went, Jesus Christ, these are mental, aren't they? But yeah, just through cornering,
they're crazy.
Grip, he cracked one of his old ribs, bless him.
I'm not surprised. I mean, me and Dave, we always had the old rib protectors underneath the suit. You had to you had to have your rib protected. If you didn't have it, go home and get it.
Yeah, you'd be in trouble.
Because you're just going to hurt yourself.
Yeah. There's a circuit called Rye House in Hertfordshire, which is actually where Lewis Hamilton used to go when he was a kid. His dad used to take him there, and that's effectively his home track. And it's really good, proper old outdoor track. And we did this charity day, and we had these teams, and it was just this endurance race, and it was just all afternoon. It was the best thing. The hardest bit was actually getting out of the cart, because you've obviously got to keep turning over and people are putting the board up and you're thinking, no, forget it, I'm going around again. And no, do you know what? I'm doing well here. I'm going around again. And the hardest thing is actually dragging yourself out of the cart on days like that.
I love that. When you make racing a team sport, that is something else. It must be a bit like the golfers in the Ryder Cup.
Yeah.
Because, you know, racing is such a singular sport. But when you've got like 3-4 of you, you know, the endurance racing stuff must be mega.
Yeah, I've not done too much of that. I've done Bathurst, a 1,000K race where it's just two drivers.
Wow, that's a track that is.
That, honestly. I can remember we first went out there in 97.
Oh, do you know what? I was there.
For the Super Touring Car race?
Yeah, I was there because we were in Melbourne and the race was on and I said, how far is Bathurst from Melbourne? Somebody said, oh, a couple of hours. I said, sort me a car out.
It's unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's literally. Anyway, as we're there in the build-up, we because it's public roads, our team manager, a guy called Didier Dubois, is driving. We've got Menu in the front. I've got Alan Jones.
Oh, my God.
Sat next to me because he drove the number two car. And I can remember we get at the top and we go over the top of the mountain into the dipper. And we stopped the car and I looked out the windscreen and I turned around to Alan and I said, are they paying us enough for this? But I tell you what, once we'd driven it, they couldn't get us in. Another five laps, just put some more fuel, I need some more. It was insane. Amazing track.
And is it literally just in the middle of nowhere then? You say it's a couple of hours outside of Melbourne. Is it just in
Mount Panorama?
Yeah,
it's just the other side of the Blue Ridge Mountain, so it's beautiful. But literally, it's a tiny little town. There's a university there. And it's steeped in history, this thing. And, you know, the big race, the V8 race, is always you're either blue, which is Ford, or you're red, which was Holden. And
did you find that the spectators there, they didn't like one another?
Oh, no. Well, this is what I was just about to say. Half of the mountain, there's a police cordon off with fair fences, and blues can't mix with reds.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So like sort of opposing football crowds?
Exactly.
Insane.
I went there, I was like, oh, I don't feel very safe here because people are giving me funny looks like, who do you belong to?
Yeah. Well, I can remember the first time I drove for the Holden team, the Works Holden team, in the build-up, they said, look, in the testing, or in fact, even in the race, but it's not so bad in the race, but in the testing, if you stop, if your car breaks down in this part of the track, don't get out the car. Really? He said, yeah, honestly, don't get out of the car. And lo and behold, a couple of days later, I had an electrical fault. I stopped at what's called Reed Park, right in the middle of the Ford area. And I'm thinking to myself, it can't be. And then full beer cans were bouncing off the windscreen.
Wow.
It's tribal. They've tried to calm it down a bit now, but it's still real angst between Ford and Holden.
Phew, I'm glad it wasn't just me, because I was thinking, this is really uncommon. You know, I go to races all the time. Never experienced anything like that.
Oh, it's hatred. It's, yeah, deep hatred. You know, it's amazing. But the atmosphere was incredible.
I've never heard anything like that in terms of motorsport. Obviously, we all know about it with football and whatnot. And
yeah,
but I never, ever heard that about the sort of the tribal element of teams.
It's unbelievable.
Because that's all there was. You either had a Ford or you had a Holden. You know, there was no Toyota back in those days, or Nissan, or... the cars are big, brutey V8 cars, and the fans are off their heads. I mean, they used to go up there 2 weeks before and bury beer, because the police then realised that we'll stop people coming in with beer with too much. So they used to go up there and bury it. And they'd claim a tree, and they'd build a tree house and put, like, old knackers sofas you get from the second-hand shop. They'd build their own grandstands, and the police wouldn't go anywhere near them. They just, right, you crack on.
You get on with it. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Terrible.
Yeah, amazing.
That's mad. Back to the car collection, Max. In terms of, we were saying this the other day, of all the cars that you've owned or still own, if you had to live with just one for the rest of your days, one and one only, which one would you choose?
That's a disgraceful question to ask an honourable and decent person. Which one of your daughters would you not throw into the pit of snakes, Maxie?
It's tough, isn't it?
I would almost say impossible. What car could I absolutely not live without? Oh, God.
See, bearing in mind, it's got to do everything as well. It's got to take you to Tesco's and it's got to excite you.
Well, I couldn't even get a carrier bag of shopping in the Porsche. Oh, God. Probably the 456.
Really?
Yeah, it's probably the car that... does everything and still gives you the thrill. Oh, my God.
And that's coming from a man that professes he wasn't a Ferrari man not that long ago.
No, exactly. Yeah. But the thing of it is that package is so amazing. You've got a massive boot. Yeah. It's a proper grand tourer. The petrol tank is twice the size of anything that I've ever driven before. It's 170 quid to fill
it. Is it really?
Up.
Wow.
Yeah. So you're just supposed to get in it and drive to Italy. Yeah, just keep going. It's not noisy. It's not noisy at all. It's got that old Ferrari kind of sound. If you rev it up, but there's no need to rev it up as well. Because
it's talky.
Thing's so talky that you get to 3,000 revs, not even 3,000 revs, and it feels like, well, I better change gear.
Yeah.
So you're driving along mostly in fourth gear and driving it like an automatic because you don't need to go down. Yeah. You just take your foot off the gas and then put it back on again. Mm. You know? It's a great car. I'd love to take it on the track because, again, it doesn't feel... It's got... great lump of a V12 in there, but it doesn't feel sort of nose heavy. It's just easy to drive, and I got the gear stick one, the geared one, because what's the point of having an automatic Ferrari, you know, and no chrome gear stick? That makes no sense.
You've got to have the aluminium H gate, haven't you?
You've got to have it.
Yeah, click, click, click every time you change gear.
Exactly. So much as it pains me to say it, that'd probably be the one I'd have to keep.
It's a tough question, though, isn't it?
It is. It's a terrible, terrible question.
It's a tough question, but it's a great car.
It is a fantastic car, there's no two ways about it.
Fantasy car garage. Two choices.
What would I have?
Two cars only.
Two cars only
in your fantasy car garage. It could be anything.
Okay. One of them would be the only other Ferrari that I like, which is the F40.
Yep.
I'd have one of them, and... a McLaren F1.
Ah, that would be in my garage. It's a proper car, that. It's you know, you get out of it, or even when you're driving. I drove one at Silverstone, and I had to really pay attention to what I was doing. You couldn't relax.
Right.
And actually, that, you know, almost a wee bit like the Marcus, where you've just got to be on it.
For me, that's driving. I don't appreciate the fact that, you know, cars through the ages have just become... easier and easier to drive. You know, you can almost, you know, well, people, telephone conversations, putting lipstick on, and still driving the car because they pretty much drive themselves.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that, you know, the RST has got heavy steering, so you've got to put your back into it. You know, you've got to concentrate on what you're doing. I mean, the actual physical art of driving is a really pleasurable thing. And the idea that you're just going to get in, switch it on, put your foot down and turn the wheel.
Yeah, there's more to it than that, isn't it? Or there should be. I don't know if you're the same, but I look back at old Formula One videos and I look at Senna before the advent of power steering, no paddles, none of that. I mean, all those guys, they were just sublime.
I don't get how they're strong enough.
I know.
I don't get how they're strong enough to hold the car with one hand, changing gear the other hand, because, I mean, the G-force that you're carrying through the corner, and you've got just got one hand on the wheel while you're changing from third into fourth or whatever it is as you're flying out of the exit and the back end's wiggling around and you're like, how on earth are they doing that? Lap after lap after lap.
It's a big physical undertaking, isn't it? But also to be driving that car and yourself to the absolute limit.
And 1,200 horsepower under your foot.
Yeah.
1,200 horsepower. I mean, come on, man. Right? There are aeroplanes that don't have that much power.
In a car that weighs less than 600 kilos, including the driver. Can you imagine?
No, I can't. I honestly can't. Yeah. I've got a lot of confidence, but I'm pretty sure I couldn't drive one of those.
And then if you go back a few years, you go back to the advent of the turbo cars with, you know, the days of Piquet in the Brabham and Prost in the Renault. In qualifying, those things had 1,500 horsepower. But they'd only last for two laps and then they'd just destroy themselves. But the power, apparently, I'm quite good pals with Derek Warwick, and he drove in that area. He said it literally, you put your foot down, there was this wet, kind of big lag, and then you hear it go, and then you'd have 1,500 horsepower at the wheels. Just hang on. Yeah. Just hang on. Can you imagine what that must have been like? No traction control, no power steering.
I'd love to experience it just once with a car that nobody cared if I binned it.
Yeah.
You know? Because I would say that it would take me a good three laps to get the hang of it. And the thing of it is, if you're not driving it fast enough, you're not going to warm the tyres up, which means you've got an even bigger chance of binning it.
Yeah.
So you've got to be brave.
Which then leads us on to the other question, who was better, the modern guys or the older guys? We can debate that all day, can't we?
You could, but for me, it's always going to be the older guys. The more dangerous the era, the more respect I have for the drivers. Yeah. You know, tarmac runoff areas, Stirling Moss would have just stopped. I'm pretty sure if they'd have, in his day, said, you know, we're going to take away all this grass and sand and put tarmac in. He said, well, dear boy, you've taken away the thrill, I'm off.
Yeah. Mm. Plant some trees, some big oak trees to hit. That'll focus the
mind.
Dig
some ditches, dear boy. Yeah, for me, those old cars, I mean, going right up to the 70s and the 80s, from the 50s, you're just thinking, it's a different breed of man that used to drive those cars. No question.
And they were used to nearly every weekend losing one of their mates.
How do you deal with that? I mean, I don't even know how you deal with that. Just the love of the sport must have been so immense.
Yeah.
You know, the only thing that I see that kind of almost just replicates that is those mad motorcycle boys.
Yeah.
When you see them on crutches, right? Yeah. On crutches going up to the motorbike, and then half the crew's got to help them onto the bike.
Mm.
And then off they go for the warm-up lap, and you think, if you fall off, mate, you might damage yourself severely forever. So I think to myself, well, the thrill must be enormous.
We were saying this the other day, actually, Jason, weren't we, about the fact that in my mind, there is a stark difference between racing drivers, and obviously there's an element of madness there, but then bike racers, that's a whole different ball game.
That's a different
ball game.
I think it's a completely different makeup of the mind, actually.
They're on another level, those boys, no two ways about it.
And I think to a certain degree, so are the rally drivers, you know.
Oh, don't get me started with them. How do they do it? They do it on tarmac, they do it on gravel, they do it on ice and snow, mud, in the fog, in the rain.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. Yeah, I know. And the way they drive, absolutely flat
on the edge,
out,
yeah.
With this poor guy beside him going six, left six, 150, and you're like, what? You know, how are you processing this at 140 miles an hour? Excuse me, somebody explain this to me.
It's crazy, isn't it? And the interesting thing is, they're not looking at the road and reading the corner. They're listening to the note of the co-driver, and that then tells them how quick to go. So they react to what comes at them, but they've already decided because they've been told how fast to go. The trust and the empathy they must have together.
Unbelievable. I've had several passenger rides.
Oh, have you?
I was in the two-seater Minardi round Donington. I've had Nigel Mansell take me round in. You remember the Grand Prix Masters?
Yeah.
So I was in the back of Nigel's car. That was a thrill. But the best passenger rides I've ever had were all rally drivers.
Yeah.
All rally drivers, because you're coming up to the corner and you're thinking,
nah,
there's absolutely no way you're getting round that corner at this speed. I don't care what you show me. And then all of a sudden, bang, opposite direction, bang, like that, handbrake, and then, and you say, how the hell did you just do that?
It's a different level, but in the same way that if you do a hot lap with a pro driver, like Jason or whatever, you do have that thing where suddenly you're hammering down the straight and you kind of think, we need to start braking now. We need to start braking now. No, we really need to start braking now. And then that's the difference for me between sort of amateur drivers and people who think they're barely tidy on a track and pros. Yeah. And you must see that all the time, Jason. It's just the difference between a good amateur and a professional is a whole different ballgame.
Well, I'll tell you where the difference is. You're right. It's all on the middle pedal. That is the one tool which make the guys that can use that better than anyone else will win races. Yeah. The brake is what it's all about. And people, you know, people that aren't familiar with racing and haven't done a lot think that's the enemy. You know, that has the biggest effect on the car in terms of how you can transfer weight and, it's all about that. That's the key.
I remember going to Le Mans. I was with the Jota team, and I won't mention the drivers' names, but my mate was doing the telemetry, and there were three drivers, and two of them were faster than the third one. And he showed me the traces. He said, you're coming out of this slow corner onto a long straight. And the two quicker drivers would brake sort of 5 metres or so earlier, get the car turned in and fire it off out down the straight. And the other guy would brake 5 metres later, fight the car into the corner, and he would come out of the corner 5 kilometres an hour slower than the other two. But by the time they got down to the end of the straight to turn again, he was 35 kilometres an hour slower.
Wow.
Yeah, brake pedal.
Exit speed is really important. Often when you relax a bit more in the car and you don't force it and try and drive fast, you just relax and work with it, the lap time comes.
Regrettably, we're about out of time. We could do this all the way. We could do this for hours, couldn't we, quite frankly? The hardest thing is cutting it off. But Maxie, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for your time.
No, thank you. It's been brilliant.
It's been great chatting cars with someone who's a self-professed car nut.
Yeah, that's about it for this episode of Fueling Around, powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your car, your bike, or your home insurance. And a huge thanks to our special guest this week, the amazing Maxie Jazz. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you, JP. Thanks very much indeed. See you at the track sometime soon.
Done. That's a date.
All right, brother.
Now, don't forget you can get in touch with us on Twitter at Jason Plato or at David Vitti. And if you've liked what you heard, then give us a top rating. Press the subscribe button and share the podcast on all your socials. So, sadly, we've got to say goodbye.